like to call the House Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Friday, April 12th, and the time is 1:30 p.m. With us today is Representative LeBron, Representative Johnston, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Josephson, and Representative Tilton. Did I miss anybody? And that is, we have a quorum to do business. So today we are going to start with HB 22, Extend Suicide Prevention Council. If you'd like to come to the table. Let me take a quick at ease. We're back, and we also have Representative Merrick. We see that the senator finally decided to join us. So we will start with SB 25, Extend the Board of Dental Examiners. And with that, Senator Wilson, would you like to come introduce yourself and your bill? Welcome to House Finance, who starts on time.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. We're just involved in another business of the state, listening to testimony in the Senate Finance, and just found a way to a breaking point to stop, and I apologize for my tardiness. Before the committee today, and committee members, thank you for this opportunity to present Senate Bill 25, is the extension of the Board of Dental Examiners. Senate Bill 25 extends the date of the dental examiners to June 30th, 2027. The Board of Dental Examiners is comprised of 9 members, 6 dentists, 2 dental hygienists, and 1 public member. Legislative audit conducted their review of this board and recommended the legislature to extend this board for 8 years, which is the date that we stated before, the June 30th of 2027. The legislative audit made 2 recommendations to this board, as they found 2 cavities so that hopefully they were repaired and fixed fairly quickly. First one, Madam Chair, is the board of examiners does the president take step to correct a regulation error. The 2016 change to the dental radiology equipment regulation resulted and a suspension of the regulations, specifically in the statute 12 AAC of the regulations 28.965 states the inspection of the must be performed by an inspector who's listed in D of the section. And D of the section was repealed in March of 16, so they still have the regulations even though those repealed. And so they just had to clean up that error, and the board did clean up that error. And the second recommendation was that Division of Corporations Business Professional Licensing Chief Investigator, in consultation with the board, to implement controls to ensure an appropriate entities are notified when licensee's prescription authority is suspended or revoked. Although the investigations were done in a timely manner, they found that none of the procedures not having, the auditors found that there were no procedures that notify the board, pharmacy, or the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration when the licensee's prescription authority has been suspended or revoked. The division has immediately addressed this recommendation by implementing controls to ensure that the entities are properly notified. If you would like to take a look at the fiscal note, there's a $35,100 note with this board. This includes expenses for board travel, attending meetings, advertising with boards, and conference fees. The professional licensing programs of the Division of Corporation Business and Professional Licensing funded the receipt of supportive services. These are all DGF. Licensing fees are covered by the cost of the board. And if you'd like, I can go quickly to the sectional analysis.
It's your time, whatever you'd like. Okay.
The Senate Bill 25 has 2 short sectionals. Section 1, page 1, lines 4 through 5, extends the board through June 30th, 2027. And Section 2, page 1, line 6, contains the immediate effect date clause. In conclusion, the continuation of the board, this plays an important part in adopting regulations to ensure the high standards of dental care offered through the state. And lastly, I believe David Logan may be here to answer any questions that served to support this board, and also our legislative audit, Chris Curtis, is here in the room to answer questions. And I urge the support of this committee to help give this a wonderful, clean recommendation after the board got done with their planning.
Well, after we vet it, we will be happy to deal with that. So any questions from the committee for Senator Wilson? Seeing none, we'll bring Chris Curtis up to talk about the audit. Do you need to get back to public testimony, Senator?
I can.
We want to make sure the people are listened to, so, you know, whatever you believe you need to do to be in Senate Finance.
I have my trusty staff is there taking diligent notes for me.
Okay, that's good to know. Ms. Curtis.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Chris Curtis. I am your state legislative auditor. I believe you all have a copy of this audit in your meeting packets. It is dated April of 2018. And just as some background, the purpose of a sunset audit is to determine whether a board or commission should be is serving the public's interest and whether it should be extended. So this audit concluded the board is operating in the public's interest by effectively licensing and regulating dentists, dental hygienists, and dental assistants. The board monitored licensees. They worked to ensure that only qualified individuals practiced in Alaska. Also, we found the board actively amended regulations to improve the industry. We are recommending an 8-year extension, which is the maximum allowed for in statute. If you turn in the audit to page 6, you will see a schedule of licensing activity. As of January 2018, there were 2,399 active licenses. And on the next page is a schedule of board revenues and expenditures. This shows that as of March of 2018, the board had a deficit of $36,000. There was a fee analysis plan for 2018. And if you're interested in the fees, if you turn the page, the schedule of fees is on page 8. So as Senator Wilson mentioned, there were two recommendations. Administrative in nature should be easy to address. The first one is easy to address. It's the regulation error. 2016 regulation changed resulted in one regulation referencing a repealed recommendation. So it should be easy to address. The second is an issue that we also found with Board of Nursing. And this is that when a licensee's prescription authority has been suspended or revoked, there's no procedures to notify the Board of Pharmacy or the federal DEA. So in our audit period, we found two licensed dentists that did have their prescription authority revoked, and that information was not communicated to those entities. The response to the audits on page 21, the board agrees with both recommendations and plan to take corrective action.
Any questions for Ms. Curtis? Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There was discussion, and maybe I'm a little behind on this topic curve, but of a level of dental practice that would allow a practitioner to serve the public in more rural, remote areas, real basic dental services. You know, they're not going to be building a crown in somebody, but cavities and preventative and this type of thing. Am I recalling that discussion from a couple years ago?
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, our audit did not look at that, but I do believe the board chair is online and could field that question.
Mr. Nielsen, are you online?
Yeah.
Could you please state your name and your affiliation and then help Representative LeBon with this question?
Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah, this is Dr. Nielsen. Through the chair, Representative LeBon, it could be that you're referencing the dental health aid therapist. Does that sound right?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Yeah, so that particular provider is not really regulated by the state or the board. So they're regulated by Indian Health Service and supervised by dentists that work in the villages and things like that. So it's hard for me to really comment too much on it other than it seems to be working.
Follow up.
When you say it seems to be working, how common is this program throughout the state? Do you know how many practitioners there are or how many folks fit into that category?
I do not have current information on that through the chair, sorry. the best way to get that sort of information would be through ANTHC or the tribes. So they have that sort of information, and since we don't license them, we don't really know the numbers or where they're working exactly.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Ms. Curtis? Seeing none, we do have some invited testimony. Mr. Nielsen, was there testimony that you would like to give?
Actually, through the chair, I was told that there might be some questions, and I don't have any real testimony other than I obviously support extending the dental board. I didn't know if anyone else had any questions for us other than what was brought up already, though.
Well, I do have one question. Has there been any regulations brought forward that might make the state a little bit more friendly about dentists coming and doing work here?
Actually, yeah. The board's goal is Madam Chair?
Yes, it is.
Is this
Representative Wilson?
Is this Representative Wilson asking the question?
It is.
Yeah. So the board's goal is really to accept all generally equivalent regional licensing exams, and we have a current regulation project that addresses this goal, and it was just signed, I think, by the Lieutenant Governor's office, and that should be in effect by like May 1st or so, and so that is the goal, and should be in effect pretty much for this exam season.
Good to hear. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate the conversation we had over the interim. Any other questions for Mr. Nielsen? I have one other invited testimony. David Logan, are you online?
I am.
Could you please state your name and affiliation and just add any comments on the improvements that you have seen on this particular board?
Yes, this is David Logan with the Alaska Dental Society. We've worked with the board for several years now to bring that change in place for dentists graduating from U.S. schools can take any regional board and then apply for an Alaska dental license there. So we're very glad to see that project finally come to an end. Unfortunately, regulation projects always seem to take at least three or four times longer than you'd desire them to, but we're certainly glad to see that come to an end. And I'd like to say that the Dental Society does support the board's extension. We feel it provides a necessary public service. And with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Logan? Great testimony. Thank you. Thank you for being here with us today. So with that, we're going to open public testimony to any others. So I open testimony on SB 25. Is there anyone else online? Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify to SB 25? Seeing none, I will close public testimony. And we have left the fiscal note, and Mr. Chambers, are you online?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Sarah Chambers, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. And the fiscal note reflects all receipt-supported services to continue the work of the board if extended through the recommended amount of time. The board, all expenses are paid through license fees. There is no undesignated general fund. If the board is sunset, then there will these expenses for maintaining the activity of the board will not be incurred. If the board is extended, they will be incurred. We're estimating about $35,000 a year for the activities of the board. And if the board is not, if this bill is not successful and the board is not continued, then the division will assume all of the responsibilities for the licensing program without the benefit of the wisdom of the board.
Any questions on the fiscal note? I have one question. I understand that the fiscal note is just what the department would incur if this board was not there. Would we then see the fees drop down to a very low amount because you wouldn't have the rest of this infrastructure in place?
Madam Chair, this is Ms. Chambers again. It's unlikely that we would see a significant savings by simply discontinuing the board. The board is a group of experienced volunteers that provide service at no salary to our division, and we would likely have to retain expert witnesses at a much higher cost to provide the expertise, both in regulations and advising regarding investigations. So the real benefit, to in my experience, goes far beyond the $35,000 a year to gather the board together to meet.
And it's not because I don't think there's a benefit to the board. I'm just trying to make sure that we're transparent on our fiscal note. So if people, so if everyone would go back to page 7 that we were just talking about, that shows our direct expenditures for this board and how much money is collected. To me, this should be on the fiscal note if this is the money that's going to be expended if this extension happens, versus what I understand you're putting on numbers if the board is not extended.
Madam Chair, if the board, if the bill passes, then we will incur the $35,000 that is required to continue the activities of the board, which is what we currently expend. If the bill does not pass, then that expense will not be part of our expenditures for that fiscal year.
So I'm going to try to ask one more time. So I'm just trying to figure out why our dentists are giving $145,216 in fees so that the board can do what they need to do. And it's all program receipts, so this is not undesignated general funds. Why we would still not put this in the fiscal note to really reflect the cost of this board?
Madam Chair, that's a great question. The only thing that changes with this board, with this bill, is the existence of the board. The rest of the program does not change. We would continue for the program to perform all of our licensing and investigative functions. So there's no, the fiscal note reflects, per the legislature's rules, reflects what the bill accomplishes, not all of the expenses associated with the entire licensing program, just the board.
So I'm going to try one more time and use my Juno question instead of North Pole. But if this board no longer exists, you would still be collecting these fees because you would still need, you know, expert help or somebody to investigate or, you know, some kind of group together to be able to still regulate this group. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Well, we're going to work on the fiscal note until I understand it. And obviously, I'm still not getting there, and we'll work with the senator's office, you know, on that point of it. Is there any other questions for the senator or anything else to do with this particular bill? Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I want to go back to your line of questioning there. I think what she's trying to tell us, you correct me if I get this wrong, but all this bill does is extend the termination date of this board. So you're saying these travel expenses, the only thing that's associated with that component, we're not authorizing the whole program like it was new. And if we were, that's where the full fiscal note would come in. Would that be fair to say?
Ms. Chambers.
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, that's correct.
Thank you.
Maybe we'll just put it on the notes so that people understand that. I just want to make sure that when individuals look at this, that they don't think that this board is only expending $35,100 when in reality it's much more than that. Just trying to make sure we all understand how much each of the boards costs. But thank you, Representative Knopp. I appreciate that. Anything else? Okay, seeing none, we're going to take SB 25 and set it aside. Thank you, Senator, and good listening.
Thank you.
And with that, we're going to turn to HB 22, and I see Representative Tarr here. I want to again thank her for quickly running us through the basic of this particular bill, and you have more time now, and you may bring anybody up that you would like.
It's going to hang in the back today.
That's okay, too.
You begin? Sure. Thank you, Madam Chairwoman, for the opportunity to be before you again. And I'll just, I guess, kind of do a little more of an introduction since we don't have the rush here and go through some of the key points I wasn't able to cover the other day. So just basically, House Bill 22 reauthorizes the Suicide Prevention Council through 2027. It's an 8-year extension. This comes following the successful audit that recommended the extension, and I know we're going to hear from the auditor on the couple of recommendations for improvement there. I talked a little bit of, the other day about my personal experience of having served on the council for the last 4 years, and so I just wanted to mention that again and a couple of key reasons why I think the membership is so important. I'd mentioned the diverse membership and the statutory requirement that, for example, there be a veteran or military representative, someone recommended from the Alaska Federation of Natives, and then an individual who's from a faith-based organization, in addition to other more expected membership that represents agencies and legislators and things like that. But those three I wanted to really touch on. First, on the veteran and military connection, of course, we know Alaska has the highest number of veterans per capita of anywhere in the country, and we also know that suicide is a major problem with our veterans. And just looking at some of the fact sheets that we have, and this is from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs 2015 date, I think this is the most recent we were able to find, but if you look at the Alaska veteran suicide rate, it's much higher than both the Western region and the national veteran suicide rate. And so I think this important partnership with the having that representation, and I think there's other data that suggests that if you are someone who served in the military, it's you're twice as likely to commit suicide. So this this issue among our military personnel and veterans is a major, major issue, and I think having that membership and that connection to the state government and the programs and the services makes it a really strong piece of this work. Having a member who is recommended from AFN and has knowledge and connections to tribal organizations and the Alaska Native community, we know suicide is an issue that really hits some of our rural communities harder than anywhere else in the state, and that the group of individuals who are sadly dying the most by suicide are Alaska Native males between the ages of 19 to 25. So we know there's a very vulnerable group in there. And I'd mentioned at the earlier meeting, this council has partnered with AFN at all of the recent meetings to provide information, training, prevention work, healing, which I think has been a big part of it. Unfortunately, a few years ago at AFN in Anchorage, actually there was a suicide, someone died by suicide at the AFN event. And so just brought it right there into the event of the significant need to keep working on this issue and how impactful it is to communities and families. And then the third, with the faith-based, was saying, you know, this I think is a really important partnership in some of our smaller communities in terms of your stable organizations at your churches and schools. And so they're good organizations to partner with. But also an important part of healing from trauma or abuse can be, you know, person's faith. I think it's, you know, a great opportunity to explore ways that partnership can be strengthened. I know over the years we've actually worked with members in the faith community to offer trainings and bring that into people who are leaders, because of course people often go to their faith leaders for advice when they're experiencing a challenging time in their life. So I just want to mention a few of those in terms of the membership and how I think it really builds strength to the work of the council in being statewide and being a connector to some of the most vulnerable populations. We know that our suicide rates are rising. I think everybody got this suicide fact sheet. We had just gotten this from the National Foundation when they came. And so, you know, I think there's one way to look at it. Okay, are we not doing enough? And you know, what could we be doing more? But another piece of data I think that's really important to consider as we think about this in relation to the number of suicides is also the number of calls to the care line. And if we just look at the number of calls to the care line, it is jumping substantially. In 2012, there were 6,956 contacts for the whole year. In 2018, there were 20,976. So even though our suicide rates have increased, those numbers are so big. You know, I guess I just think those two data points have to be considered together, because we don't know, you know, sort of the individuals that were calling the care line, the outcome could have been different, right? And so, you know, this resource and showing how important it is really tells you that, you know, even though those numbers can be hard to understand and figure out what we need to do and why we need to do more, the calls to the care line tell me, you know, the raising awareness, making sure there are resources available for people who are in crisis is absolutely essential. The audit, as I mentioned, had a couple of items for recommendation. I'm going to let the auditor talk to that. But I do want to talk about another sort of requirement and piece that I hope people will consider, that we produce an annual report on suicide prevention, and we have just completed the third one, the recasting the net. And what I had passed out from this, because I think, you know, to be action-oriented about this and think about steps we can all take, is the part that comes at the end, which is the checklist of things we can all do, a list for individuals and families, communities, and again, at the statewide level. And I think what we've learned and the work of the council over these years, you know, we're always trying to incorporate the sort of what we know when we learn how to do something better, trying to incorporate that into the work that we're doing. And I think what you see on this checklist reflects some of the data that we have, some of the information about what we know is working. You know, that's why on here, call Caroline or someone you know needs help, share the number with people you meet. You know, that's something we can all do, put in our newsletters, talk about it at our constituent meetings. So I think, you know, this kind of work of having the diverse group coordinate and come up with this kind of plan and then be able to share it with communities and organizations and churches to help be part of the solution is how we're going to achieve the change that we hope to achieve. The fiscal note I know will come up and we'll look at that. The funding for this was included in the base for Department of Health and Social Services as we passed the budget, so it's not in addition. It's already included in what we have considered the budget as it came out of the House. And one piece of that is the funding for the grants, and I think we can potentially have the department talk a little bit more about that. That was incorporated into the work of the council, I think it was 5 years ago. But I've been able to work with Sharon Fischel, who I know is also online from Department of Education. And these grants come through the council and go out through DEED to schools for the primary prevention. Very promising early intervention kind of work with young people. She can maybe talk, if you'd like, about some of the different grant programs. But that's the other piece of the fiscal note. And again, all of that was included in the base as we considered and passed the budget. So that's in the budget. It's just that we need to pass the bill that continues the council on to match the two pieces of this up. So I think I'll stop there and see if there are any questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions for the representative? Representative Carpenter.
I'm not sure if it's a question for the representative, Madam Chair. Thank you, but maybe somebody else can answer it too. I'm looking at the findings and recommendations from the audit, and the prior 2012 sunset audit recommendations here, one of them which is the council should develop and monitor performance measures. And so I was kind of curious, how are we measuring success with the program? I see one little chart here that shows 2007 to 2016, Alaska Native, Alaska Non-Native, Alaska and U.S. Statistics rate per 100,000. And I'm not seeing
a. Can you tell us what page you're on? I'm sorry,
I'm on page 7.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Exhibit 3. And I know that's it's hard to quantify how many people didn't commit suicide. So how are we measuring success of a program? What are our measures of effectiveness here?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, it is a very difficult question to answer because, again, you sort of don't know who was thinking about using suicide as the way to die by suicide. We just kind of don't know that. And that's why I wanted to point to the Caroline numbers, because when we hear from the Caroline folks, and I'm just thinking, should have maybe tried to have them online today, they'll report to us at the quarterly Suicide Prevention Council meetings, and you know, I'd recommend anybody give a call and talk to them a little bit about the work they do. Talk about very intense work, definitely, you know, interacting with people in a moment of terrible crisis, but they, you know, do everything they can to, you know, keep the person on the phone and then kind of try to get them connected to resources. So I don't think anyone really has an answer for you if we measure progress in that way. But we look to the numbers from the Caroline as an indication that the demand and need is growing for individuals looking for services, you know, to address when they're feeling in a crisis situation. I would say when we look at the grants, depending on what metric you want to use,
Certainly some of them do work that involves a training program, so the iTalk Assist program, for example, that goes into high schools and is trying to teach students to sort of speak up if they see something and, you know, make sure that basically we don't sort of have a hidden problem. And that's often, we know, when people are experiencing depression or feeling bad, sometimes they don't speak up, or somebody knows and, you know, doesn't speak up and try to get them connected to someone. So I think, you know, if we're looking through that, we could more easily have some metrics of how many students have participated, you know, get some feedback from the students themselves. You know, everything I've learned is that it's been very successful, and that the students, you know, are really engaging and taking some ownership on issues. And so once they learn, you know, learn some of the skills and do the skill development, then they can also be a part of, you know, sort of the support network for people. You know, so I think if we look at metrics that are a little bit more kind of geared towards, say how those things were supposed to be achieved, of providing training, providing services, that would be a little more quantifiable. I just don't know how we could get to the number of maybe the number of deaths that are prevented by the work. That's a little bit harder.
Just a real quick follow-up.
Representative Carpenter.
So I know that this is maybe just a little bit of semantics here, but we're looking at in 2007, and I think that's as far back as the graph goes anyway. You're looking at 39 rate per thousand, 39. And then in 2016, we're looking at 42. So over the time span, we haven't really seen, I mean, it's a marginally increased number for the suicide rate. So as we're spending $500,000, a little over $500,000, are we seeing the results that we want to see with this $500,000? It looks, from that, you know, snapshot on that graph, it looks like we have a very small increase since inception. So how do we justify spending $500,000 and we don't have a declining number? How do we know that we're being effective? The number here says that we're not.
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, I think that most people think the numbers would be a lot higher if we weren't doing this work. And one of the challenges when we look at breaking it down in small segments of the population, particularly just looking at Alaska Native, if you remember, there have been some really tragic incidents. And unfortunately, when someone dies by suicide, sometimes it creates sort of a domino effect. And so if you think of Hooper Bay, just a few years ago, there were a number of suicides in quick succession. So this is a really tragic outcome that happens often with young people. If one person dies by suicide, a friend, then, you know, there's sort of a contagion kind of thing. And so one of the things that happens is just when we look at the smaller segment of the population, sometimes when there's an event like that, it really influences the data, if you will. And so I think just two things would be that people think the numbers would be higher if we weren't doing this work, and that with small populations, sometimes an unusual incident like that where there are a cluster, if you will, of deaths is influencing the overall rate.
Brings up a good question, follow up.
Representative Carpenter.
What, in that instance, and I know this is maybe sensitive and there may be some specifics that we shouldn't discuss in public here, but maybe what did the Suicide Prevention Council actually do in that situation?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, and thank you, because it's an actually really important part of the work to talk about as far as training that can be offered. So there's prevention, intervention, and postvention kind of training. It's, you know, what do you want to do before, in crisis, and after. And in that circumstance, immediately got people from the community connected with resources for the postvention kind of training, sent resources to the community, and tried to, you know, basically provide the kind of support that would be necessary for a small community like that to respond to such tragic events that happen in such quick succession. So that postvention training is actually something the council wants to look to do more of, because we know of sometimes this the way once one happens, then another follows. So that's actually an area where the council would like to do some more focus. But when you think about kind of some of this training, none of it was happening before. And so it's just been kind of a few years that we've really been trying to offer the training. The earlier years of the council, you know, as it got started, the funding for the grants weren't there. So it's more been in like the last 5 years that more of this training is being offered. And I think, you know, we just need a little more time too to keep working at it. But I would say, you know, in those circumstances, and to my knowledge, people responded that that was, you know, very helpful and really sort of critical to the crisis response after those incidents.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, could you give us an idea of some of the work that is done through this particular council with regard to their grants, how that's dispersed, and then on the receiving end, what's actually happening out in the communities? Of course, I want to see their success rate, but I really want to hear kind of the application process of it all. What are they doing out in the communities?
Mm-hmm. Through the chair to Representative Sullivan Leonard, I'll take a stab at that, and then Sharon Fischel from Department of Education is also online, and I think she's actually the one who's doing the administering of those grants, and she'd be really able to give a lot of detail on that and make sure you get exactly the information you're looking for. But through, I just come at it from a few different sort of angles. One thing is earlier on, the council was trying to really work on setting up frameworks, and the framework has been this coalition model. So there's actually a Juno Suicide Prevention Coalition. There's two coalitions in Anchorage. There have been other coalitions that have been tried to set up around the state. Some have been more successful than others. That's kind of why I make the comment about the churches and schools. One of the things that we've noticed is in the urban centers, it's been a little bit easier for sustainability and longevity for those coalitions. In some of our smaller communities, it's been a little harder to sustain those over time. So trying to sort of build and strengthen that. So I'd say that's one thing that's happening in the communities. And those coalitions, you know, often include people from the council or people who are working closely with JAMI, for example, in Juneau, or NAMI of Anchorage. And trying to get, for example, Juneau Suicide Prevention Coalition, they often do big training events, and they've held some conferences here. You may see announcements for events that they host sometimes here in the spring. So, you know, they get out into communities, provide training, provide not really the support and things like that, because that's really one of the focuses of NAMI, is doing that peer-led support for families who have experienced things or have family members who experience mental health issues, but more providing training, providing, you know, speakers, conferences, that kind of thing, connecting people. On the grants that go into to the schools, those are geared towards primary prevention programs and teaching. A lot of the work more recently has tried to incorporate what we know about being trauma-informed and how beneficial the trauma-informed approach is. And so I don't want to sort of steal their thunder because they did amazing work, but Ms. Fischel maybe can talk a little bit more about it. They've recently completed some training modules that can be used for education professionals, but also any of us could also log in. And that was one of the things that was really important to us. Some of the funding that was used for that, we wanted to make sure that the public had access to it. So the training module was set up so that there's several hundred like public slots, if you will. So if it costs, you know, $10 per person, we made sure to reserve some of that for members of the public. So the funds were used to produce the training. That has longevity because it's done in a webinar kind of format, so, you know, it can be used for multiple years. And then also make it available to members of the public, or especially we were thinking that individuals that work with children, child care centers, some of those places that are less resourced and don't have capacity to kind of take on these things themselves, you know, we're hoping, okay, well, maybe they would say all of you should go, you know, take this important training now that can be done online. So there's that kind of work happening through the grants. And then again, what to Representative Carpenter's work, there's kind of the prevention, the postvention, that kind of work trying to go on in communities. So I hope that gives you a sense of some of the different pieces of it, but perhaps again, Ms. Fischel could give a little more detail on some of the specific grants if that's of interest to you.
Representative Sullivan Leonard, would you like to hear from her? Ms. Fischel, if you could put yourself on the record and please just talk about the grants, where they go, what the application looks like. Just walk us through it.
Hi, yes, I'm Sharon Fischel. I am an education specialist here at the Department of Education here in Juneau. This grant program, I'm just going to start with, it saves lives. It saves students' lives. It saves teachers' lives. There's a lot of effort that's went into educating staff. In 2012, there was a law passed, Senate Bill 137, that required all educators to receive suicide prevention training, and I'm sure there's several of you that are aware of that when that happened. And since then, through the department's online e-learning system, we have had over 18,000 of our 23,000 users take one of our four suicide prevention courses that we developed in collaboration with the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council. That's just one piece of this. We've developed several trauma courses also, because the correlation between students and adults that experience ACEs and suicide is very high. So that's been a big part of some of the work that we do. The grants that go out over the course of the 5 years that we've had these grants, we've had over 20 grants that have went out to different school districts and some specific schools. Some of them use their grants for sources of strength. It's a peer-to-peer model that's been used in the Kenai Borough, in the Juneau School District, where they train students to work with other students in building assets and building resources and building their resiliency. Our Fairbanks School District has been using their two past grants to incorporate signs of suicide with all of their middle and high school students, where they go in and teach the warning signs, and they also have students that are working with students. A big part of what's kind of transformed with these grants over the years is that they're moving to a peer-to-peer model. Almost all of our districts are using some sort of peer-to-peer model, where they are training students to recognize signs and students to talk to other students with, you know, adults and mentors in place also. Lower Yukon has been using the youth leaders, as well as Bering Strait has been using the incorporating the youth leaders, where they're bringing kids into retreat and turning the, teaching them how to be resilient and how to work with their friends and other younger kids and older kids. The Matsu Borough has been training all of them in question, persuade, refer. You are not alone. Some of you might have seen pens or pencils or different things that say you are not alone, that has the Caroline number. The Matsu School District has done an awesome job of bringing in up to 200 to 300 students every fall and training them on how to deliver a lesson to other classrooms on suicide prevention or bullying or different things like that. It's just been a phenomenal kind of program. I had one of my grant administrators say to me one time that, you know, he's a federal grants person for his district, and he said, I manage millions of dollars of grants, but this small grant that I get for suicide prevention saves lives and has the biggest impact out of all the millions of dollars that he manages. And so that's just a little bit of what's going on, but they do so many things. We have grantees from all around the state. Every 3 years, a competitive process is put out, and districts are asked to apply for the grant. They're all required to use an evidence-based or promising practice along with the other activities that they are doing. And throughout the first two grant cycles of this, over 137,000 Alaskans have been touched or have been part of the programming of this grant, and that's students, parents, staff, and community members.
Representative Leonard, do you have a further question?
I don't.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great information.
And this Representative Wilson, if you could please get my office, the last couple of years, where these grants have actually been allocated to, and any kind of application form that is required from any of those who would be receiving funds, I think that would help the committee a lot. Representative Carpenter?
I just have another quick question. Does the department keep any non-attributable statistics. I know this is going to be sensitive as to when someone brings forward this issue. So non-attributable statistics on either suicide ideation, attempted suicide, or successful interventions. Do we have any of those kind of statistics that back up the claim of we're saving lives?
Ms. Fischel, did you hear Representative Carpenter's question?
Yes, I did. Thank you.
Could you please respond?
Through the chair, we don't necessarily keep those specific stats here because they're always personally identifiable. I also am support for all of the school counselors around the state, and so when different things happen, they'll reach out to me if they need support, or sometimes if they just need somebody to talk to. I take it anecdotally from a lot of the counselors and a lot of the staff that I work with that are out in the schools. We have the youth risk behavior survey that shows that's done every couple of years, every 2 years, and some of the questions that are asked is, you know, whether you're depressed, whether you've considered suicide, and whether you attempted suicide. The last stats we have were from 2017. They're currently administering that right now, so I'm not sure right now where the trend line is going with those. So we collect that as a survey from the students, but as far as collecting those types of data, we don't necessarily do that here at the Department of Education.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when determining whether it's an appropriate use of our resources, and we're talking $600,000 here, what we've got to go on right now is 137,000 people touched. And I'm not sure what that means. Seems to me that going forward, if we extend this, that the next time we have this conversation, if the department were able to keep non-attributable numbers, meaning if something comes in, it is that data is translated to a sheet that does not have names on it, so that we can actually have a conversation about how many people and how many incidences were positively affected by the $600,000, that would be an appropriate way for us to judge whether this is successful or not. Because to say that we've had a conversation with somebody and that number is 137,000, and so it must be successful, is not a adequate way to judge success of a program. So I would ask the department or whatever we would need to do to make that possible for them to collect these statistics. It seems the appropriate way to manage a program with measures of effectiveness.
Thank you, Representative Carpenter. I just had one question on the suicide courses. Is there any fee attached to any of the courses that are out there for whoever wants to take them?
No, these courses are free to Alaskans.
Any further questions? Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure who the question is for, but getting back to the concern of the increasing numbers of suicides, and using that perhaps as some sort of measurement for the effectiveness of programs like these. My question is, the whole issue of suicide, suicide awareness, suicide prevention, hasn't that come to the forefront in the last 10 years or so? And I'm asking the question, is it possible that we have more documented suicides because people are more paying more attention to the issue in the first place, which might mean that previously suicides really wouldn't be documented, and not that they didn't happen, but they just weren't documented, and now that there's this awareness push, that might be a reason for the increased documented suicides. Is that a valid question?
I think it's a valid question. I think, as Representative Tara said, it's probably one that's very hard to figure out. But I think that's a good point that you've made on how do you measure some of these programs.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, and I don't know, after maybe Ms. Fischel has something to add to that, but
I would say there's a couple of things, and the Department of Health would probably be the better kind of department to be talking to in terms of the public health data. But previously, one thing that would challenge this is that when someone died by suicide, sometimes that was not actually how it was recorded on a death certificate. So you have some challenges with things like that. Sometimes people go in for, you know, different overdose that may not be immediately understood to have been an attempt to die by suicide. So there's some challenges to sort of like all the quantifying of the people. But just for example, again, on those Caroline numbers, just looking at 2018, you know, the July to September quarter, in 2018 there were 4,894 calls, but in 2019 there were 4,902. So we, you know, we do see that jump. In the next quarter in 2018, there were 5,107. So this would be the most recent that we have for 2019 now, 5,559. And so there continues to be this increase. So there's more people who need the service, or more people who know about the service, for sure, because more people are using it. And I think what's happening, you know, and perhaps I could call in between meetings for Representative Carpenter, the Caroline folks, I don't recall them discussing some of the more specific data that you're requesting at our meetings. But I think they, because they're on the phone with people in crisis, you know, may have a little more information on kind of that piece of it, because what you're hoping is right, that you're able to provide the service that works with someone through this crisis, and the outcome is not that they die by suicide. So, you know, I think they definitely have success stories. I know that. I mean, I definitely can attest to having heard them and know to that to be true. It's just getting at the exact kind of quantifying it in the same way that we are able to quantify some other things may be a little more challenging on this issue. But certainly, you know, understand where you're coming from and the desire to make sure that dollars are being effectively spent.
Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Backing up just to the grants, you, Madam Chair, had asked for a list of the grantees throughout the past history, and I would be interested if you would please share that with us, because I'm wondering if most of the grantees are going out to the government agencies, or if some of the grantees are involving some of the faith-based organizations and other organizations. So I would appreciate it if you could share that with us as well.
So. Absolutely. Anything that comes in will be shared with the committee. I said 2 years. Is that enough to get an idea of what we're basically looking at?
Yes, that would be great. Thank you.
Perfect.
And yes. A second question?
Absolutely.
Thank you. In the fiscal note, it says that the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council, they're developing and implementing the plan is their most significant statutory duty, and there was a new revised plan that went from kind of an intervention to more of a prevention and promoting. Could you just talk a little bit about that?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, through the chair, to Representative Tilton. So this is the Recasting the Net, and it's available online if everybody is interested in getting one, and that's where that checklist came from. And in my work in public health, and Ms. Fischel, please add to this after I'm done, what we've sort of transitioned to, we have a lot of models where it's been more a crisis response model, and we know that sort of that's the most costly intervention, point of intervention. And so, you know, in all the work that, you know, I've been a part of, whether it be domestic violence and sexual assault, child abuse, suicide prevention, everything is shifting to trying to, you know, people say get farther upstream, get, you know, closer to the cause of the problem, earlier intervention, and much more on the prevention side of it. And one of the reasons is that, as Ms. Fischel mentioned, all of the grants are awarded through to a promising or evidence-based practice. So now people really want to use evidence-based models, so not just wonder if we're going to use something that's going to work, but no, for sure it's been proven to be a model that works. So they're using the evidence-based models. What evidence-based practices tell us is that the earlier intervention and prevention is the most effective, and it's the most cost-effective. And so, you know, efforts trying to transition it there, especially I think working with the young people, it's really about developing the skills, not only for themselves, of how they experience and address a personal crisis, but then being a resource for a family member or friend if they were in that same situation. The more we build those skills early, the better off, you know, they will be, and when we think about that very vulnerable group of young men, the 19 to 25-year-olds, you know, hopefully if we're getting to them when they're middle schoolers and teaching them, you know, these skills and how to be resilient, you know, we're gonna see a drop in that group.
Thank you. We're going to finish with Representative LeBlanc, and then we're going to go to Ms. Curtis. We have quite a few people online for testimony, and we'll still have time for more questions, and then we'll have Representative Josephson's question first then. Representative LeBlanc, and then Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Has the history of the funding for this program been pretty static, or do you know, Representative, what that history is?
Mm-hmm. Through the chair to Representative LeBlanc, it has been. The early years, there's just been basically the one staff person who staffs the council, and those are the associated costs. Once the grants were factored in, if you look at the funding over the last 5 years, it's been pretty consistent. It's basically the staff, the travel for the council, because the quarterly meetings, what they've tried to do in the past is visit a community. So during my time on the council, we went to Prince of Wales Island, visited four communities there. We went to Barrow last fall. And what we do when we go to a community is do site visits. So we go in, and so, for, you know, as a legislator, that's such an incredible opportunity to get in and be on site and see, you know, what facilities, where the state dollars are going, you know, understand the staffing, the unmet need. So there was the travel funds and then the grants. And so it's been, you know, pretty just consistent that it's been those items. And if you look in the fiscal note, and I think they can address this, but, you know, again, this came up on your earlier bill, sort of just estimates, you know, the cost of the position as it costs today, you know, over those years. If it's the same person, there'll be the little, you know, annual merit increase, if you will. But otherwise, you know, it's the position and, you know, that for that, and then the travel and the grants. Now, under Governor Walker, they had done a travel freeze. So even though there was money approved in the budget, then once the travel freeze happened, then dollars were not spent. So there were a couple years there where it looks like it came in under budget. But during that time when we didn't do that, I would say with this group, that was difficult and met with some resistance because of the strong desire to get out into communities and really try to be that resource and make those connections.
Representative LeBlanc.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking at that graph on page 7 that Representative Carpenter referred to, it tells me that we do have a serious problem in Alaska. I think we would all agree with that. What it doesn't tell us is truly how many suicides have been prevented by our actions. So one observation would be to find out what that might actually be as far as a measurement would be to zero out this program, not fund it, eliminate it, and then watch the incidence of suicide, how that changes. But I don't suspect anybody would suggest that as a good strategy. Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Yes, through the chair, another, I think, sensitive topic related to, and following up on Representative LeBlanc's comment, it strikes me that in the event where there's a failed attempt, there can be great costs borne by the public. In degree far greater than the fiscal note. Am I right about that?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, yes, and in fact, on the handout that I gave about the facts and figures, there's a little bit of information on that. It says, this estimate, suicide costs Alaska a total of $226,875 combined lifetime medical and work costs lost in 2010, or an average of, you know, almost $1.4 million per death. And I think that's because when you figure if someone's only, you know, 19 years old when they pass away, you know, that whole, what could have been a very long life and impact. So very, very costly. And beyond the dollar, I lost my brother who died by suicide, and I shouldn't have brought that up. The personal impact, I know every family that's been impacted will think about for the rest of their lives.
Thank you, Andrew.
You represented. So we're going to bring up Ms. Curtis to go through the audit. This is another sunset audit. Ms. Curtis.
For the record, my name is Chris Curtis. I'm your state auditor. I believe you have a copy in your packets, or was it handed out earlier?
won't give you page numbers if you don't have a copy of the audit.
We have a copy of the audit.
So again, a sunset audit dated August 2018. Overall, we found that this council is operating in the public's interest by actively broadening the public's awareness of suicide prevention and by coordinating the efforts of other suicide prevention entities such as state agencies, regional groups, coalition, and local communities. And has already been discussed, the council fulfilled its statutory duty to release and prepare a statewide suicide prevention plan 2018 through 2022, recasting the net. And they work closely with the plan stakeholders to add and refine the plan strategies, resources, and indicators. We are recommending this council be extended 8 years, which is the maximum allowed for in statute. If you turn to page 4 of your audit, there is a schedule of expenditures and funding sources. This shows that the council is funded entirely by general fund appropriations, and it shows that in FY18, the council spent just under $600,000. I know there's been some questions about activities by the council, and if you turn to page 8 or 9 and 10, we provide a detailed list of council activities that were conducted during our audit period. And then we have the two recommendations that start on page 12. Both are administrative in nature and easily addressed. So recommendation number 1, we recommend the council's executive director develop and implement procedures to ensure that public notices for meetings are published timely and accurately. So from July of 2014 through March of 2018, there are 18 meetings held, and we found that 5 of those were not public noticed timely or accurately. The deficiencies were caused by a lack of procedures. And then recommendation number 2, we recommend the council chair develop and implement written procedures to ensure the performance evaluations of their executive director are conducted annually. Statutes require that the evaluation be conducted annually. During the audit period, there should have been 4 conducted. There were only 2 conducted, and it wasn't clear why they were not done timely. Again, we believe these are easily addressed. Responses to the audit begin on page 23. The Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services and the Council Chair agree and concur with the report conclusions and recommendations.
Any questions?
Yes.
Representative Josephson.
And just to be clear, in all of the cost-cutting measures the administration has proposed, this they want left untouched. Am I right about that?
Through the chair, I don't know. I don't have any comments about that.
We will ask the chair of the Health and Social Services on that. Representative Johnston.
Thank you for the chair. How did you audit as far as the coordination between all the suicide groups and the state agency? Only because, I mean, I know that has been an issue in the past, and you've seemed to feel that there's been an improvement here.
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, you mean we believe it's been an issue with their coordinating in the past as far as being a prior audit recommendation?
No, I've just heard that at times it's been an issue, and you've noted here that you found that they have coordinated the efforts of suicide prevention entities, including state agency, regional group, coalition, local communities.
Through the chair, certainly we, as part of the audit, we sample and review and read the board meeting minutes. We review their annual reports. We conduct interviews of stakeholders and council members. That's how we get to the conclusions about coordinating. And this council serves as, the statutes say they serve in an advisory capacity to the legislature and the governor. So what we do is look at whether they've been accomplishing their statutory mandate, which we believe they have. And another statutory duty is to develop that statewide plan, which we see that they've done and have done timely. So we've been looking at this council since they were created. Mm-hmm. Initially, sort of a rough start. We had some criticisms. We may have even recommended termination at one point back in the early phases of it. And now we've seen the council expanded, and this last audit and the last audit before was very complimentary of the council and how they're conducting their business and their ability to coordinate all the different entities spread around the state and the importance of that role.
Thank you.
And maybe you can help Representative Josephson with his question. As the chair of the subcommittee, was this money that you put back into the budget that was removed from the governor, or was this still left in the budget from when the governor came forward? Do you recall?
Madam Chair.
I better not answer that.
Representative Josephson might have answered his own question.
Well, I just got some confirmation from the sponsor that the governor wants to keep these monies in place.
Oh, actually, and
Representative Johnston.
I have somebody in the back room trying to remind me. And it was interesting in the governor's report because as they were listing the priorities of departments, you know, on the scale of 1 to 5, this actually had a 1, but that they did fund it. So it was it didn't have one of the highest rankings, had one actually one of the lowest rankings, which we found of interest, but they did fund it.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure we put in the record. I do have a question, though, on page 3 of the audit report, and it under 13 on the public member, when it talks about that the executive director also serves as the executive director of the AMHB and the ABADA councils, but then it says per the agreement that these two other entities would pay the personal services and travel costs for the executive director until such time as the council has the resources to contribute. At that time, do you know whether they were looking at other funds besides general fund monies or what other funding that they had when this was put together?
Certainly, in the prior sunset audit, not this one, but the prior one, we had a recommendation that we saw this co-location put in place during that audit period, and it was working fantastically. But there was nothing documented as far as an agreement between the three entities. The person was just serving. And we said, you really need agreement. You need something set out. And so this time we came, we saw that there was an agreement. And that's what it said. We didn't go into details what they may have envisioned as far as what that other funding mechanism. I just assumed they meant general funds. When general funds would be available to help pay for the cost, then they would help contribute. But we didn't do any work as far as what the three entities were thinking when they made that agreement. We didn't ask those questions.
So do you know if the Mental Health Board has ever participated in funding any of this program since they are one of the benefactors their constituency is?
We do know that the Suicide Council itself is not paying for the cost of the personal services. Isn't that per the agreement, those other two entities pay the personal services and travel cost. Until the time, so what you see for personal services on page 4 is not the executive director.
Okay, so
that is a staff person to the executive director.
Well, I guess I was just trying to figure out, too, where, at what point, I guess, who they thought would also contribute, whether or not, you know, the Mental Health Board would contribute or maybe partially contribute, or the alcohol, you know, behavioral health might, you know, it just did seem like just the way this was written that they, you know, saw that other resources would be available. It just doesn't say where.
Through the chair, right now those two other boards are paying the executive directors. So as far as where they thought additional, I just assume they assumed that the Suicide Prevention Council would help contribute at some point down the road if monies became available.
Any other questions for Ms. Curtis? Okay, we have a few that are online that are invited testimony as well, so we're going to go to Barbara Franks first. Barbara, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
So could you put yourself on the record and your affiliation, and you may begin your testimony.
Okay, my name is Barbara Franks, and I currently live in Inelchik, Alaska, and I am with the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council and with the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, and have served in other entities and capacities on boards and commissions. But today I am standing in front of you here as a mother of a child who died by suicide. And, you know, as mothers, we always think of, no matter how old they are, that they're always going to be remaining that age when they die. My son was 23 when he died by suicide, December 14, 1997. And 2 days later, my husband of 25 years lost his battle to cancer. And I was able to get some help through on how to deal with my husband's death through the American Cancer Society. But then there wasn't any 1-800 number for me to call. There weren't any websites to get information on what to do after the suicide. So at the age of 52, I went back to college and I got my associate's degree and gathered all the information that I could on even how to help myself, because I do have a remaining son. And I didn't want him to think that he lost his mother, because he just lost his brother and his dad. And so I'm glad that even 21 years later, you know, as advocates, we always want everything done yesterday. And as family members, we want to know, where are you? When I was in Juneau a couple weeks ago, there was a gentleman that had jumped off the bridge. And after spending 30 years in Juneau, I knew this young man. But, you know, what was different from my son's suicide to his was that, you know, while I was testifying on this exact bill that I had received during that short period of time, almost 300 people who sent me a text or sent me an email saying that, you know, we have someone here that just jumped off the bridge. But what was so different, again, is that, you know, the coalitions that we had built through the council, the Juneau Suicide Prevention Coalition was there, and they're going to be there at the funeral on Saturday. And we had worked with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention that had that vigil. And so people who weren't able and still have that stigma and that taboo about suicide came because they said, maybe I need to know more. So as people and as a mother using my lived experience, we share on how to safely talk about suicide. When that newspaper article came out, it showed the Caroline number on there. And so even the people that don't come to conferences, that don't sit down to workshops, can read and know that they don't have to wait until there's a crisis before they call that number. So thank you for listening to me, and thank you for your concerns about how we can continue, because we can't stop now. You know, even though I've been, I have not had a job since 2014, I still have people who come to me and say, you know, thank you for even sharing that card with me, because it's a tool, and I hope you don't need to use that tool, but just to have it there to know that we're an arm's reach away for you to call for help. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, looks like we also have, is it James Bila from the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention?
Hi, good afternoon. My name is James Bila. I'm the lead field advocate for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, the Alaska chapter, and I live in Bethel. For the past 4 years, the Alaska chapter, AFSP, has drastically improved working with the statewide Suicide Prevention Council by sharing information provided by with trainings. The council has also assisted me at the Elder and Youth Conference, where the past 6 years I've had the pleasure of doing chapter presentations on suicide loss, lived experience, and surviving after a suicide. The council has also increased their participation in the International Survivor Suicide Loss Day, which is held the Saturday before Thanksgiving. They've been providing the Alaskans support survivors of ALN using appropriate cultural activities through the different agencies that they have throughout the whole state. The Statewide Suicide Prevention Council, it's also aligned with the National Strategy for Suicide Prevention and the American Indian and Alaska Native National Suicide Prevention Plan. It's also aligned with the AFSP goal of reducing suicide. The AFSP, which is a national nonprofit organization, highly recommends the support for House Bill 22 to extend the termination date for the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council. I know the nation has seen an increase of suicides this past year, showing a 30% increase. And Alaska rates have reported to have been risen by 13%. Although the rates have increased, not only in our state, but nationwide, I know there was a discussion, we really have no data on how many lives that were actually saved. I know recent suicides out in this area that I had to respond to, the parents always come out and say, at least you have saved one life. I know the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council has assisted me in responding to suicides out in the Southwest region. And as far as the school goals, I work full-time as an itinerant school social worker. And for fiscal 17 suicide prevention training, we trained roughly 1,395 students. We had 222 requests. And what we understand is out of the 119 requests, 89 were kids that had thoughts of suicide, and that was used in the programs that Sharon Fischel has discussed with the help of the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council. In short, we really recommend that the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council be extended. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. So we're going to open public testimony up now on HB 22, and we're going to go to Lily Wirtz. Lily, if you could put yourself on the record and who you represent, you may begin your testimony.
Hello, through the chair, good afternoon, House Finance Committee members, and thank you so much for hearing my testimony. For the record, my name is Lily Wirtz. I'm 29 years old, and I'm a lifelong resident of Anchorage. Today, I am representing myself as a person with bipolar disorder whose life was saved as a direct result of calling the crisis care line as they got me to seek help and seek hospitalization. As others have said, but it bears repeating, overall suicide was the fifth leading cause of death among all Alaskans, first among ages 15 to 24, and second among ages 25 to 34 in 2017. I know we're discussing budget here, but what we can't afford is to lose more lives. The Statewide Suicide Prevention Council is critical in ensuring that these rates do not rise, and they are instrumental in reducing this tragic loss of life. I ask that you please support HB 22 and extend the council until 2027 and beyond. We have to continue to let this council advise us on this public health crisis and to coordinate efforts statewide to save lives. Thank you.
Thank you, Lily. And we're going to go to Tina Walsh. Tina, if you could put yourself on the record, please. Tina, are you there?
Hello?
We can hear you.
Right now I'm really high suicidal.
Yeah.
And I want every police officer, the CITC, crisis intervention controlled. Does that make sense to you?
We kind of lost you on some of that. Could you just repeat it? Are you on a landline or speakerphone?
On a speakerphone.
Okay, can you take it off speaker and just talk into the phone? Sometimes it's really hard otherwise.
Okay.
That seems better. Go ahead, try again.
Okay, so I want every police officer, CIPC, crisis intervention controlled. Can you hear that?
Yes. And is that all you want to add?
No. I also want to add that women need to be treated differently. But I don't want to be in handcuffs. I don't want to be that way. Do you get that?
I'm sorry, but for some reason, you just keep breaking up, and so we're just getting a little bit of it.
Okay, so I don't want to be in handcuffs. Did you get that?
Is there any way that you could send your testimony into us by writing? Because it seems like we're just getting a bad connection.
Oh, of course. It's always the same way, isn't it? I do not want to be handcuffed.
Gotcha.
There you go. Did you get that?
We did. Thank you. Can we have an at ease? Back on the record, we just want to make sure that we are getting the right numbers out to the individuals. Thank you, Tina. Thank you for calling in. We're going to go to Brenda Moore. Brenda, are you there? Okay, she's offline. Okay, so we're going to go here in the room. And looks like we have a few people who'd like to testify. Linda Brazak, would you like to testify? But you're here. Okay. Ben Schoenover? Okay. And how about Sam Trivett? Just here for questions?
No.
You're up. It's all yours. Thank you. If you just put yourself on the record and who you represent, you may begin your testimony. And thank you for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sam Trivett, T-R-I-V-E-T-T-E. I've been a resident of Alaska continuously for 65 years now. I've lived, worked, and volunteered all around Alaska, mostly in Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Juneau. I'm a resident in Juneau right now. I'm speaking today as a member of the Juneau Suicide Prevention Coalition. I've been a member of the coalition for about 11 years now. I'm also speaking for myself as a citizen of Alaska. I want to thank the sponsors of House Bill 22 today for introducing the bill that would extend the statewide suicide prevention council for 8 years. This is the third session that I have testified on behalf of the council extension in the last decade. I'm a survivor of suicide loss. My wife and I lost our son Pete to suicide on June 28th of 2007. I've been a very active participant in our local coalition for about 11 years now and been involved with the council for the last 10 years and have participated in a number of the council's statewide conferences, regional conferences, and trainings and with other Alaska partners. The council has linked us to some national experts, resources that have helped us to tackle this major public health problem in our country. The council is the glue that binds us all together and keeps us working on suicide issues. Alaska has done much work on this difficult issue in recent years, and I continue to volunteer my work because I see positive changes happening all the time. A couple examples, you've already heard one from Sharon Fischel over Department of Education. What you don't see is that they had a couple of people at the recent council meeting that took place here in Juneau from the MATSU program that are working that program. They now start at the fifth grade level, start talking to the kids, and they've trained enough kids in high school that the high school kids are coming down to the middle schools and to the grade schools and talking to the kids, with of course having the counselors and teachers there as well at the same time. And so I see this as a major change. They're getting down a much lower level in school now, and it is also peer-to-peer, which means, as all of you know, when you're dealing with kids, they're going to be paying more attention to each other than they are to the adults in the room. And I they actually showed us some videos. I think the council was on the agenda, had the MATSU people on the agenda for about 45 minutes. And I've participated in the trainings that go on here in the school. Science of Suicide, Sources of Strength, and those are excellent programs, and they are, as they said, evidence-based, which means the national experts have certified those as the kind of programs that are effective. And one of the things that has already been talked about is the increase in calls. We're never going to get, I don't think, a cure for all the diseases in the world, and I think there will probably be suicides for a long time. I think one of the first things is you do is the best practices is to get people to acknowledge it's a problem. And I think that certainly is a factor, Representative Carpenter, in having a lot more calls now than we had 3 or 4 years ago. The suicide hotline has only been going, I think, for about 6, 7 years now. And it took a while to get that information out. All of us, including our local coalition, has those numbers on it. It's branded all over the place in the state now, and I think we're getting more calls because the stigma is disappearing to some extent, and people are beginning to understand that it's Alaskans that are doing this. This isn't a national call center. This is Alaska. All the calls go to Fairbanks, where those folks are a grantee to deal with that. And some of the other things that are going on that are a result of this is that an increase in the number of Alaska hospitals and healthcare clinics are using are screening for suicide risk right now. I unfortunately ended up in the hospital here. I've seen my medical provider this last year. I was screened in both locations. And I think that effort, every time they, whenever people are doing screening, they always find people who are at high risk. And I guess one of the things that I can talk from experience to some of this is that I've been a member of the Juno Coalition postvention team for 10 years now. The postvention team is one that gathers when there has been a suicide. Everybody knows about the suicide that was on the front page of the paper. When that happens, as we meet as a group, we have members from all around the community that come together, and we gather all the information, including information from the police, mental health people, and we try to determine who is at most risk. We then contact all those people because you're always concerned about contagion. Are there other people that are likely to commit suicide because of this? And I, of course, I'm not going to talk about details. Those details are confidential. But I can assure you that we made contacts with dozens of people around the state and people that were connected with the family that live elsewhere. A lot of resources were put out, and that's what we do. Whenever there is a suicide, we do respond in that manner. And I personally know that there are no stats on this stuff, and I'm sure they could probably be gathered, but I think the Careline stats are probably some of the best we have, that we've increased the use of that hotline more than triple over a period of 4 fiscal years. That's pretty amazing. That's pretty amazing. And, you know, your marketers would tell you that's almost impossible to do probably, but we have. So, again, I think the council has been in the forefront of helping us do some of these things, and we're beginning to have impact. I wish I could say there'll never be another suicide, but there will be, I think, unfortunately. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else online? Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify on HB 22? Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony to HB 22. I would also like to put on the record that we are House Finance. It is our requirement to question where the dollars are spent. That does not mean that we don't think of any type of program is or isn't important at that time, but that really is why we are the Finance Committee. And with that would be the perfect time to look at the fiscal note. So, Ms. Brazak? Yes, please. And really just the top part, we're going to be waiting for the Department of Education on the grant portion of it. But if you could just go over the other numbers that you have. And
good afternoon. My name is Linda Brazak. I'm the Administrative Operations Manager for the Division of Behavioral Health. We oversee the boards and councils within our division. So, the fiscal note represents one position. It's a range 16. It is a full-time position. It's classified. We also have travel funds that are used to bring board members to meetings. Our services line represents department-wide and statewide chargeback costs. We have commodities, which represent materials for the council, and then the grant.
Could you by any chance tell us how much the Careline itself, the cost of the hotline to keep it going, do we know per year how much that is?
I don't know off the top of my head, but I can get that information
to
you.
Committee, I would appreciate that. If you send it to us, we'll make sure everybody else gets it.
Okay.
Are there any other questions on the fiscal note? Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We heard that in a previous administration had reduced the travel costs, and I was wondering if you could talk about what the, you know, how that, what that effect was and what the you were not able to do.
Actually, I probably could have Eric Morrison, who's the council position, speak to that because he would know more clearly what was able to be accomplished or not.
Please put yourself on the record.
My name is Eric Morrison and I'm staff for the council. So what was the question in particular?
Thank you. My question was that we had heard previously that as you look at the past history of the funding of the council, that in a past administration, the travel line had been reduced. And I was wondering what was the effects of the reduction of that travel line and what was it that the council was not able to do?
Okay, so as was spoken earlier, the council, through the chair, as was spoken earlier, the council originally we tried to meet on a quarterly basis across the state. Several years ago, it just wasn't feasible to do that with the travel funding that we had. So we had gone to having video and teleconferences during the summer periods. Then when the travel freeze came in, I believe in 2015, 16, we started going to two, then to one quarterly meeting in communities. So as was spoken earlier, when we do the outreach and the site visits, that's some of our biggest outreach each year. So we've met in Uktagavik this past fall. We've met in Nome. We've met in Prince of Wales. We've met in Bethel. Those are the some of the key partnerships that we build, such as with Jim Bila, who spoke earlier. So we haven't been able to establish and maintain those relationships with the communities as well as we'd like to. We do invite people to provide public comment and present to us via teleconference, but that's not as effective like I said, the building of relationships. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you, and can you restate your name for the record?
Eric Morrison.
Thank you, we just need to make sure we had that on there. Are there any other questions about the fiscal note? Thank you very much, we really appreciate it. Amendments for both HB 22 and SB 25 will be due by 5 o'clock on Monday. Are there any other questions that we have for today? Our next scheduled meeting will be Monday, 1:30, HB 32, Alaska Energy Efficiency Loans Eligibility, and a presentation of PERS and TERS by the Department of Administration. And with that, we'll see you on Monday. It is now 3:07.